Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's March 2024, and you're listening to episode 385, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the novel and television series of Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. On this episode, I'm joined by Hilary Ferrer, who is the founder and president of Mama Bear Apologetics. Hilary is the author and editor of two best-selling books, Mama Bear Apologetics, Empowering Your Kids to Challenge Cultural Lies, and Mama Bear Apologetics Guide to Sexuality, Empowering Your Kids to Understand and Live Out God's Design. Hilary has written an online, in-depth book review about the book and also the television series for Lessons in Chemistry, and her article is called Lessons in Anger, the Global Phenomenon of Bonnie Garmus's Lessons in Chemistry. You can read her article at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Hilary, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, we are going to be doing a spoiler-filled conversation of both the book and the Apple Plus TV series for Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. And actually, this book came to my attention because I kept seeing, you know, just people reading it or just kind of lifestyle pieces in the media about it. And so I asked Hilary if she would cover it. And as of the March 3rd, 2024 New York Times bestseller list, this book has been on the list for 93 weeks. And that's almost 2 years because it was first published in April 5. And I'm not sure, I mean, the hard copy, it's still on the hardback bestsellers list. So I'm not even sure if it's in paperback yet. And what's interesting was I was like, okay, we're going to cover it. Hillary's going to read it. I went to try to check it out for my local library, and I had a 3-month waiting list, and there were just hundreds of people on it. And finally, I just was never any closer. I said, I better get a copy of the book. And just before this podcast, I just popped onto my local library, and I see that it is still so hard to get. It's 9 weeks out for 133 copies and more than 500 people on the list. So needless to say, 2 years later, this, and I don't know if it's from the TV series or what, but this book is hitting some kind of cultural chord, especially with women. And so I just wanted to, first I want to just kind of get an overview, as so many women have been interested in this book and said it's been life-changing. Do you think that this book did what it set out to do, which is kind of, you know, talk about the plight of women and how they're treated? And it was kind of like a feminist way of talking about stuff that happened to women today, but she sets it in the 1950s.
Yeah. So it's like, in terms of, did it accomplish what it think, what she wanted it to accomplish? I think it accomplished way, way more than what she ever even dreamed of it accomplishing. And as an author, that's always a good problem to have. But in interviews with her, it started out as really, in fact, there's even an article that says, I'm so glad I wrote this while I was angry. Where she was in a meeting for, she's worked as, I think, in marketing or something like that for a very long time. And she gave a whole presentation on these ideas of what she thought they should do with this particular, advertising client or whatever. And the room was just silent. And then there was some other dude that stood up and basically, well, it was like, well, I've got some ideas. And then he basically repackaged everything she had just said with her presentation still like on the PowerPoint, on the screen in front of them. And all the men in there were like, oh, yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing ideas. And she tried to be like, hello, did anyone not just hear me give a full presentation on this? Like, this is all the stuff that I just said. And nobody would pay attention to her. So she says she went back to her desk and basically wrote a whole, she wrote the first chapter on that. And so in a lot of ways, I think that there was kind of some built up anger, some pent up anger that she'd had for being treated like this as a woman in a lot of traditionally male-dominated fields. And so I think it's interesting that anger really does kind of come through in the book, in the sense that this is what I picked up on, is it seemed like this book was almost intended for people who were already angry, and who wanted to have, you know, almost that reason for being angry. I know that Melanie, you and I have talked about how there are so many tropes in like the first, you know, 30, 40 pages. And you and I have watched some people who are giving their perspective on the book that they came to the same thing that we did, where like somewhere around page 38, I think one of them said, she's like, every single trope that could possibly happen. Like one of the reviews on Amazon, it says, it feels like the author has learned about every bad thing that has ever happened to women in STEM and made all of them happen to Elizabeth. And I would say the same thing for every bad thing that's ever happened in the name of religion and made them all happen within the book. So in that sense, I think getting people to be angry about things that really, I think legitimately we should be angry about, whether or not they're always happening like that in society, I think that's the nerve. And yeah, so in that sense, I think she really has accomplished what she wanted to accomplish, because I think people are drawn to this because it makes them feel something. Unfortunately, the two things I think it makes them feel, I think that makes them feel angry first, but then she gives a way for them to feel empowered in spite of their anger. And I find that anger and empowerment are oddly close together, that sometimes people get a false sense of empowerment from being angry. But as you've mentioned, there's also people who said, I've changed my life based on some of the things here. So they got angry, but then they, you know, they started moving and shaking and trying to change the things that made them angry. So yeah, I think she really did accomplish her goals.
I just also want to note for our listeners that if you go on to Amazon, you'll see this book has almost 272,000. Yes, that's almost, you know, a quarter of a million ratings on this book. So this has really touched a nerve, I think, particularly for women. But before we talk about some of the content of the book, will you give our readers an overview, a big overview of the plot of the book and its main character, Elizabeth Zott?
Yes. So Elizabeth Zott is supposedly in chemistry back in the, I think it was like the late 1950s. And then as the book goes on into the early 60s. And she is really dealing with the fact that this is a male-dominated field, that she's wanting to do her PhD, but they're trying to block her. She has some guy telling her that she's not smart enough, or they're taking her work and they're putting her name on it, putting their name on it, which, I mean, that doesn't happen just between men and women. That basically happens with anybody who a person has more power than. If you have more name recognition, you did. I mean, actually, there was a woman who was the one who really kind of got the photographs of DNA and then is kind of labeled or known to be kind of like the silent partner in the ones that with Francis and Crick, who got the spiral design of DNA. So it's like this really does happen. But I've also heard of it happening just among males who maybe weren't as well known within the publishing industry. People take each other's ideas all the time. So anyway, she's dealing with this. She has one of her higher ups that tries to sexually assault her. When she fights back, she basically stabs him with a pen. And then, of course, the policemen are like, is there anything that you regret doing? Would you like to issue a formal apology? You know, like, oh, I'm so sorry that I stabbed you when you tried to sexually assault me. So that's kind of how it starts out right there. And then it just has a lot of the other things that are going on. So she has to start working as kind of a tech in the labs, even though it's clear that she knows more than a lot of the other characters in there, but they're all men, of course, so they have the jobs. And when she finally gets pregnant out of wedlock, they say, well, we have to fire you for this. And so she has to find a way to make money as a single mother. And so she kind of stumbles upon this cooking show in the sense that this media producer's daughter keeps stealing her daughter's lunches. And when she goes to confront him about it, he realized, oh my gosh, you would be perfect for this TV show. And so it goes into the TV show. And this, I think the TV show honestly is where the crux of everything happens, because they really rightfully point out how many housewives feel like they're just completely belittled and completely overlooked for the work that they do. And Elizabeth Zott's character comes in, she makes them feel smart. She makes them feel capable. And she reminds them that what you're doing matters. Feeding your family matters. Feeding them healthy food matters. And so it really is this character who suddenly, it's interesting because within this feminist trope, we also have this woman who is advocating for the importance of the role of mother. And so she stays in that for a while, doing the show until eventually at the end, she goes back to doing her chemistry as well. But just the way that she's able to have an impact on the housewives, and I like what she says in the book, page 202, she says, there's nothing average about the average housewife. And I think that right there is almost this battle cry of why this book is hitting, also hitting so many people. So that's just kind of, and in the midst of this, she has a relationship with kind of the male counterpart of her, in the sense that someone who's kind of always been alone, he's sort of been an outsider. He just happens to be a Nobel Prize winner. And so then, of course, when they start dating, everybody accuses her of trying to sleep her way to the top, or that she's stealing his work instead of them working together. So there's this beautiful romance in there, and this beautiful, what does it look like to have a partner who actually sees you as an equal, which, as sad as that is to say, I think there's a lot of women out there who don't have partners who see them as equal. I'm so blessed to have my husband see me completely as an equal. And he married me because he loved having these conversations about apologetics with me and about the Bible. And he wanted someone who really was a peer in that sense. But so she's switching jobs. She has this love interest. And then, you know, she has a daughter out of wedlock. And it just kind of shows what she has to go through in order to make things happen as a woman that maybe a lot of men didn't have to deal with.
She meets Elizabeth Zott, meets her partner. They work at the same lab, and the book and the Apple Plus TV series tries to show just how much she was discriminated against because she was a woman, and that her boyfriend, who, spoiler, dies early in the book in a kind of freak car accident.
That part actually did shock me. I did not expect to be surprised in the book.
Them to kill off the main character, that quickly.
Yeah.
But so the fact that in the movie series, and I'm not sure if in the book as well, she just has to point out the sexism in the current workplace, which he does not receive any. He only receives great attention in the book and the TV series because he's so well known, and he's been lauded as this amazing chemist. And so he's kind of untouchable in the workplace in terms of, you know, he gets all the best equipment, he has a private office and all this stuff. So I thought that was kind of how she set up showing the sexism in the workplace.
Well, the double standard, really. And I think this was just in the TV show, where she says, well, if the man were here, would you fire him? And they're like, well, of course not. And she's like, that's my point.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it was good. I think it was very interesting and how she uses the workplace to kind of show the sexism between the differences of how she's treated versus how her boyfriend Calvin is treated, because he's almost kind of worshipped. You know, he's this smart guy bringing in all these donations. So why do you think that it's attracted so much attention? You know, I noted the 272,000, you know, reviews on Amazon. Why do you think it's really hit a chord? I think particularly with women.
Yeah. First off, we really need to sit and marinate. Coming from an author who I know what is considered, you know, a high number of reviews, we really need to sit and meditate on this idea of 272,000 reviews. Because usually reviews will capture maybe one-tenth or 1/20th of the number of people who've actually read your book. So as Christian apologists, when we see something that gets this much attention, which, like, honestly, I have never, ever seen anything on Amazon with that many legitimate reviews. It's something that we need to pay attention to. If for no other reason, this is something that people are talking about, Christian and non-Christian. And if it's something that people, Christian and non-Christian, are talking about, we can always use that as a stepping stone to the gospel, as a stepping stone to introduce the Christian worldview, where we find what is good about this, what is bad about this, and just kind of start that conversation. So that's why we're really paying attention to this. I'm sorry, what was the second thing about the second question? Why it's hitting the female audience.
Well, yes, what I was saying was that it seems to me that in various interview pieces and videos on YouTube that I watched where they're talking to Bonnie Garmus, the author, that it's women that she's empowered through the story who've resonated with her situation. And basically, I think that Bonnie Garmus has taken a lot of 21st century types of things. Not that those things didn't happen back in the 1950s, but almost some of the issues that women are dealing with in 21st century, and stuffed them all into one book.
Yeah, that's what I've heard one of the commentators say, that they took a 21st century postmodern feminist and put her back in the 1950s. And it's like, okay, then shake it up, see what's going to happen. But the reason why I think this is really attracting women is the one thing that still is going on in 2021, probably even more so than it was in the 1950s, is that people are belittling the role of motherhood and the belittling the role of the housewife. And I would say that they're doing that more now than they did in the 50s. Back in the 50s, they had an expectation that everybody was going to be a housewife. But in a lot of ways, if they had that expectation because they understood the importance of that role. Nowadays, it's almost unpopular to say that someone's going to be a housewife because that has been so depreciated and lowered. Like some of the things that I noticed about the book was how much it kind of, I don't even want to say soft sell. It almost like demonized the concept of being a mom. Let me see if I can flip to the number of things that children were called in this book. A tyrant, you're in indentured servitude, more demanding than Nero. It's a little Satan, a gremlin, horrible, selfish little sadist. These are all things that were, you know, they're referring to children as. And I can imagine a lot of moms kind of giggling and acting like, well, this is kind of what I think, you know, when I would never say this out loud, but this is what I would kind of think. Cause you know, children are, it's like they don't care about your needs. They care about their own needs. And if they need something, they cry. And that's how babies are. They have no way of communicating. So I think it was kind of almost making a joke out of something that is something that a lot of women already feel that motherhood is hard. But also it really kind of downplays it and it almost dehumanizes these children, which I don't think is a great, you know, a great response to it. But like one of the other things that was said by one of the characters was, you know, in the book, they were asking the characters, why do you like this so much? And she says some, like one of the responders said, well, I like how she uses all sorts of sciency language. It makes me feel capable. It makes me feel like I can understand this, that when men had this expectation that women really couldn't understand anything. Oh, you know, you're just a woman. You're not going to understand that. People have kind of done the same thing to housewives here in the 21st century, acting like, you know, I've heard people making fun of like mommy bloggers as if they have no idea what they're talking about, especially ones that are wanting to understand what's going on with their children with scientific or medical stuff that, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's just a mommy blogger. She's just a housewife, just a housewife. And that's why I think that there's nothing average about the average housewife that she says on page 202 that there's a lot of women probably applauding and saying, you're saying the quiet part out loud. Finally, someone actually takes this seriously. And we really can't take, we can't underestimate the fact that there are so many women who want to be taken seriously. And I think this book kind of gave them an opportunity to say, yes, finally, someone is taking us seriously. Now, in terms of the book, so I would say this kind of puts I think it actually does the opposite of what it's trying to do. Just coming from someone with a science background, and especially, I don't even have like a really great background in chemistry. I was a, you know, a high school chemistry teacher, but when they are using stuff that I'm like, oh my gosh, there's no chemist who would ever say that. There's no PhD chemist. They're quibbling over what a covalent bond is or, you know, just making everything, you know, instead of saying, you know, grab the vinegar, oh, please, you know, grab the CH3COOH. You know, oh, I'm sorry, that's 4% acetic acid. You're like, normal people know how to talk normally. And so it's like, if I were a misogynist man reading this book, I would say this is why we don't let women do science. Because even when they feel empowered by doing science, they're doing such bad science that they don't even know that they're not doing good science. I would say the TV series, that's what I really loved the most about the TV series, is it didn't do that. You had actual scientists who were writing the dialogue on that, and it was actual science dialogue, but it's kind of embarrassing what supposedly empowered women science-wise in this book, because it's just such, I don't even know what to call it. It's so basic that, that bothered me just coming from a science background.
If you have missed it, you might not know that last year we took our print magazine, which had an incarnation of more than 45 years. And if you've been subscribing, we thank you for your generous partnership with us. But now the Christian Research Journal is still continuing, except we're continuing online and all of our content is absolutely free to everyone. No subscription required, no paywall. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but a couple of well-known magazines have gone to online-only subscriptions, except for you have to pay for their content. You don't have to pay for any of our content. And that means really tens of thousands of free journal articles spanning back more than almost 45 years are completely available to you. And so you might want to take advantage of that by going to our website, equip.org. In addition, did you know that we started at the beginning of this year in 2024, a brand new podcast called Christian Research Journal Reads, which are Christian Research Journal articles, and there are audio versions of those articles. So on this podcast, you can hear me talk to our different authors about their articles. And on that podcast, you can actually hear the article read to you. So if you're not already subscribing, wherever you get your favorite podcasts, please subscribe to Christian Research Journal Reads. And there's, I think, more than 10 episodes on there right now. And we hope to bring you a new article read to you each week. Now, we do want to thank you so much if in the past, as I said, you subscribe, but even if you haven't, we would be really grateful if you would continue to partner with us and give us a tip for all of this free content that you're getting. You can easily do that at equip.org. If you hit journal and you click on the Postmodern Realities podcast, you will find at any landing page, you will see that there's a link to give us a tip. And we really appreciate that because we continue to bring you all of these great podcast episodes, both on the Postmodern Realities podcast and now on Christian Research Journal Reads. And so something small like $5, $10, $15, everything helps. And we are grateful for your financial partnership and your prayers. And if you would like to just give us the gift of your time, what really helps us out on the internet is, of course, helping us out with the algorithm. And that means to write us a review or a rating, specifically on Apple Podcasts, because that's where most of the comments are aggregated there. You will help other people find our podcast if you go there and you write us a review. It just takes a few minutes of your time, but we'd be very grateful. And now, back to my conversation with Hilary Ferrer about the best-selling book, Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. One of the things you talked about a few moments ago was the various different tropes that the book had in the first several dozen pages of the book. And like the YouTube reviewer, actually, I think I texted Hilary and I was just like, are you kidding me? Like I'm only not even to page 100 of a 400 page book. And I just, this is going to be a slog. So what are some of the different specific tropes that you thought, especially some of them I thought were very modern, not that it didn't happen then, but it was just the layer of upon layer of all these cliches that she just stuck in the very beginning of the book.
Yeah. So first off, I literally wrote tropes/cliches in the back of the book and started listing them when I was on around, you know, the third page 30 something. So we got Calvin the orphan, we got Elizabeth who grew up in this really horrible religious upbringing where the parents hated her homosexual brother so badly that he committed suicide. And she's, of course, not just an average looking woman. She's got to be like the gorgeous woman that everybody loves. And she's the gorgeous female scientist that everybody, you know, loves to hate. Although I did hear an interview from her and she said she'd started out with a really kind of average looking woman and said she changed it when she found out that men had a tendency to think the prettier a woman was, the less smart she was. So I don't know if that's like really true or not, but I just thought, of course, everybody wants the role model who's the drop dead gorgeous, you know, scientist rather than just an average looking scientist. All the comments about women, oh, you're just, you know, waiting till you can go back and have babies. We know you. You're just going to be in the workforce until you can find yourself a man and have all these babies. All the Catholic sex abuse that's going on. So we just have, you know, the past abuses of the shyster upbringing, you know, traveling revival preacher, you know, the orphan, the abuse, the homosexual kid that commits suicide, the sexual assault that she has, the men taking credit for her work, all the things. That's like all within the very beginning.
It is a lot, and I think that might have drawn modern women into the book. But is there anything that you think that the book actually did well?
Yeah, and that's kind of the point that I kept saying over and over again about page 202. There's nothing average about the average housewife. And I think she really does in the time, like in that time, she elevates the role of the average housewife. Now, it doesn't seem like she's doing that in the book for that time. I don't think she necessarily does that in the present for us. I don't think she elevates the cause of the housewife in the present, but she definitely elevates it in the book. And so I really did appreciate that, because that is something, especially with all the stuff that's in food these days, and creating really nutritious meals really, really matters. Taking care of the body, being the one that's taking care of children and making sure that they're growing up well, with things like we can't underestimate how important food is. We really can't. So I really did like that. I like that there's some ways where there was just legit bad stuff going on and she didn't take it. She didn't just stay quiet. She spoke up and said that this is not okay. And that's something that I think I take it for granted, just because I grew up in a family where it was okay to speak up for myself and it was okay to say when something was not appropriate. And so I think there's a lot of women maybe who did not grow up in a background like that, where we sometimes need permission from someone else to do what the healthy thing is to do, but it's like we're waiting for someone to give us permission. So there's a lot of ways I think this book allowed women to have permission to, you know, pursue their dreams, to actually try for something more. I think a majority of women are really going to be called to be wives and mothers, but there's some where they also are called to do something else with their life as well, you know, doing writing. Or she had this one character. The only place that we really saw really good science was in this one character who wanted to become an open heart surgeon. And then it's supposedly this average housewife that busts out with like knowing everything about, you know, protein plasma membranes and energy constriction on that and stuff. And I was like, okay, that's a little weird, but it's like, and then we see later, this woman actually does go on to become an open heart surgeon. So I love that she empowered women to feel like I can do things, because there are women who do wife and motherhood because they don't think that they're capable of anything else. But there's also women who would choose career because they think it's beneath them to be a wife and a mother. So I think in that sense, we have kind of pros and cons, both of them represented here.
I think it's interesting in both the book and the television series, prior to, you know, her boyfriend dying, Calvin, they talk about marriage and he wants to propose. And she was just like, oh, I've never wanted to get married and I don't want to have children. And so she definitely says that. And of course, she unexpectedly becomes pregnant, and then now she's the single mother after he dies. But do you think that there are ways that the book and the TV show show how motherhood surprised her? In other words, she did not want to be a mother and she has this daughter. And ironically, she names her Mad because she's mad when she, you know, the nurse comes along. What do you want to name the child? She's like, well, you can name her an emotion. And she said,
how do you feel right now? She's like, I feel mad.
So then later on they say, okay, it's for Madeline or something like that. But, you know, she didn't want to be a mother, and yet there are ways in which motherhood surprised her in a good way. So what would you say the book and TV series shows about that?
I would say at the beginning, when it's just an infant, she doesn't see anything. She would have been one of those very classic postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety kind of people that's not feeling the bond with the child, that just doesn't feel motherhood as good at all. But yeah, I think that as it depicts reality in the sense that you realize you don't even know what you're missing before you have a child. And then when you have a child, you're like, how in the world could I have ever possibly imagined not having this child in my life? So in that sense, it portrays it in a really good way, just showing how you kind of grow into that role and you don't have to be there from the very beginning. I also noticed, though, a lot of times places depict single mothers with children who are way more mature sometimes than even they are. Like, if you think of Gilmore Girls back in the 90s, it's like everyone's like, oh, it'd be so cool to be a single mom because you've got this, you know, girl, Rory, who's like way more mature than her mother is. Yeah, it'd be great to be a single mom if all your kids are more mature than you are, or if they're just so mature you don't have to lay down the law almost ever. But so in that sense, I thought it was a little bit, everybody wants the precocious child who knows how to use their words and who knows how to talk about when they're feeling a need and they don't understand the need, instead of just going into a wild tantrum. That's what, you know, everybody would always prefer. So the book doesn't really, the book or the movie don't really show Madeline being like a real child in that sense. But at the same time, they do show how she can't imagine her life being different without this child. And I think that really does represent reality well. And a lot of women who would think they never wanted a child, never wanted family, suddenly discover, wow, I feel extremely satisfied. I feel extremely fulfilled by this. So I think in that sense, it was a wonderful depiction.
But I think one thing about the book that we can say when they've had just a bunch of cliches written in there, especially at the beginning, especially when she talked about, you know, I don't have parents because her dad basically was like a word of faith type of preacher and, you know, just kind of a huckster doing little tricks and sleights of hand to make people think he healed people or things like that.
Thinks that he did a miracle. The TV show did an even better job showing that, I think, really making it clear.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, it doesn't seem, it is quite anti-Christian in the book. So what did you think of just all the anti-theist sentiments and scenes in the book?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's like we have to recognize that there are people out there like this, and we need to, I feel it's very important for us to also get mad at things that should make us mad. And even now in the 21st century, we have these huckster shyster televangelists and you know, traveling evangelists who do all the things that her dad did. And there's a lot of people who are turned off from Christianity because of that. So I think if there's something that's been harming people in the name of Christianity, I'm almost kind of fine bringing attention to that. Now, what I always want to have is a redeeming aspect so that someone can say, oh, that was like that fake Christianity. But then they have this other character who's actually the real true Christian. And the TV show actually displayed that. I don't think the book did. The book really just kind of reveled in this idea that faith is basically believing in something you know ain't true. I think that's, who's it? Like Roy Rogers said that. Science is all about evidence, which I think it's ironic that she's looking for evidence, but her main field is abiogenesis. It's like, okay, you're trying to create something that happened in history, which you're never going to have exact evidence. Even if you can do something, there's no way to have evidence that that's actually how it happened in history. History is unprovable. So, it was a little bit incoherent in that sense, but I think we should be angry about all the sexual abuse that's happening within the church, because if anyone follows the Julie Roy's report, we know that that stuff is still happening. We should absolutely be angry about the people that are doing the health and wealth Christianity, because that's still happening, and we really need to be angry with that. Now, a lot of things get put on God in the book, and they try to make it sound like there's no evidence for Christianity, and that itself is just, you know, a real basic apologetic conversation would you know, they use the whole telephone game idea for the Bible. And I mean, that's like one of the first things apologists train in. So this would be a good way to start having conversations with people and be like, oh, the book talks about how there's absolutely no evidence for the Bible. Do you think that's true? And find out if the person thinks it's true. But yeah, there weren't any redeeming characters in the book, but there was a redeeming character in the TV show.
So definitely there's this anti-Christian thread there, but what kind of role does Bonnie Garmus have religion play in the group, in the book, as opposed to what is the role of science in the book?
Yeah, in the book, the role of religion is almost all negative, if I remember correctly, since I kind of, it's kind of hard once you've watched the TV show to remember, okay, which one was from the book and which one was from the TV show. They really made science the hero, as if science, you know, solves all the problems, science answers every question. And if someone does have questions, science is okay with it. Religion's not okay with it. It just has a real caricature of Christianity, and science is the hero of the story, because science is exactly the way the main character is, completely dispassionate, completely logical, completely rational. Although I would say that there's a lot of ways that she was so logical that she was illogical, and so rational that she was irrational, kind of in her character, the way it was portrayed in the book. And that science basically gets around all these agendas. Science gets around all these personality quirks. Science gets around it, you know, and all you're left with is truth with science. It's a real deification of science. And especially as they're going back into something where they're looking for how was the world, how did the world start? How did life start? This is a religious question. And they start looking to science for it. So it really does show you what it looks like to deify science.
You know, it is definitely fascinating how, like, the book and the limited Apple Plus TV series, while the TV series, it is fascinating that it does cue somewhat. There's also ways in which it is different from the book and doesn't completely 100% hew towards the tenor of the book. So did you feel the same way about the limited TV series that you did about the book?
I didn't feel like, I'll be honest, I really didn't like the book. I thought it was shallow. I thought it sounded like a woman who was angry that was trying to make other people angry and is capitalizing on the fact that everybody's angry and they need another reason to be angry. So we're going to, you know, depict all these things that'll make you angry and then you feel justified in your anger. That's basically how the book read to me and that's how it felt. I loved the TV series. I thought the TV series was so well done. You know, everybody says, oh, you know, once you read the book, you're going to hate the movie or whatever. No, this is one of those things where I couldn't stand the book, but I love the movie that came from it because it was more balanced. It made the characters less cartoonish and caricature. It gave them actual personality in some ways and was able to show kind of a range of complexity that just wasn't depicted in the book. So the book almost read like a really good first draft for a really great TV show, which is exactly, you know, ironically what happened. And that the TV show really has redeeming aspects of religion, especially with one character that is a priest in there that is so open. I love the way he has interactions with Maddie, the little girl, and she's asking questions and it doesn't scare him at all. And she's telling him, oh, you know, we're told not to believe in God. And he doesn't go on to like, oh, why shouldn't you believe in God? He talks about something completely different. He builds a relationship with her. He does exactly what we as Christians should be doing, which is finding someone who's clearly hurting because, you know, she's still hurting because she doesn't know her dad. Her mom doesn't really talk about her dad. She wants to know who her family is. She wants to know where she came from. And she just needs someone to talk about it. And clearly her mom is too traumatized from the death of the father to really be able to talk about it. And so he really steps in and shows what the church is intended to be. And so from that reason alone, I love the TV series.
I would say that in the book and the TV series, this idea of friendship and family is definitely woven throughout. And you were just mentioning how her little girl, Maddie, in the TV series is really trying to figure out her origins. And then we find out in both the book and the TV series that does some, you know, backstory type of stuff that Calvin, her boyfriend who ends up dying, the father of her daughter, Mad, he was an orphan too. And so there's kind of this theme of friendship and family that is woven through both of those. But how do you think it's handled in each? How is it different in the book versus the TV series?
Different from the book and the TV series, this is where I start to kind of forget which one was in which. I love the relationship that they have with the lady across the street. So the lady across the street, I think her husband's around in the book. Am I right in that?
Well, in the book, they have her kind of almost as an abused, an older white woman. She's almost kind of abused. Her husband doesn't recognize her. I think he might have done some physical abuse to her.
Yeah.
It's suggested. And she kind of befriends her neighbor, Elizabeth Zott, because she wants to get out of the house because she doesn't like her husband at all.
Okay, yes, yes.
But in the television series, they add a whole new wrinkle because it's now the 1960s. So they put an entire like civil rights subplot into it, which is not in the book.
Not in the book. But the way that they form the family, like I really do think a lot of ways it's just being the family. I think back into some of the epistles where Paul is talking about, you know, whoever is left, father, mother, brother, sister, family, home, gains even more. And he's talking about in this life. He's not even talking about in the next life. Gains in this life so many more homes, so many more brothers, so many more sisters, so much more family because we have the family of Christ. And I think that that's really depicted well on what does it look like to make family with the people who are around you in your immediate vicinity. And so I loved how beautiful that was with the kids across the street and the mom across the street. Yeah, in the book, the woman across the street, yeah, she is abused and her husband is, I think they talk about him like he's so stupid, he doesn't even know how stupid he is. You know, just like ugly people don't know how ugly, they wouldn't know how ugly they were if it weren't for mirrors. I mean, there's a lot of just real snarky things like that, just bashing on men as if that was the norm. But even despite that, the relationship, the way that she wants to be there for Elizabeth Zott and kind of stands in the gap for a single mother who really doesn't have any kind of family around her, I think that that really gives us a picture of what we should be as the body of Christ.
So what are some positive ways Christianity is portrayed in the TV series? Because that's what really struck me. Because I want to say to our listeners that if you read both the book and or just watch the television series, there is a lot for the Christian apologist ends to kind of use as a springboard to talk about Christianity and faith and God and creation and all those kinds of things. So what are some of the ways in which Christianity is portrayed positively in the TV series?
Yeah, in the TV series, I think with the relationship between the priest and the little girl is really great. He doesn't even know who she is. He can tell that she's just looking for history on her father. And so basically he kind of helps her do history to find out where her father came from. What is the orphanage that he grew up in? And he does a lot of the stuff that she as, you know, 6-7-year-old wouldn't really know how to do. I think there was some places in here where it talks about the science is the how, religion is the why. I think that can be a little bit confusing, but it still shows the relationship between science and religion. Like Madeline, she was reading Origin of Species. And his immediate response to that is, if there's one thing that Darwin and I agree on, and then he goes, and I didn't write out what else he said, but he says, if there's one thing that Darwin and I agree on. So basically he's looking for things that he agrees with. And this is something that goes along with Mama Bear apologetics, how we say you need to be looking for that common ground, speaking the person's language. And one of the other things he talks about is something that brought her dad and him together is they both loved asking questions. And I think that so many there's this reputation that the church has that the church is not a place to ask questions. And showing a priest who has a little, you know, interacting with this little girl who has 1,000 questions, who's been told by her mom that the church won't answer questions, and say, not only did I want to help answer your questions, but I want to encourage your questions to begin with. I don't think we realize how empowering that is for people in terms of empowering them to return to the church. There was a girl I was interacting with once who was talking about she'd been involved in a lot of really, really, hyper-fundamentalist kind of spiritually abusive stuff growing up. And so basically I listened to some of the stuff she was going through, and I went and I apologized and said, you're so right. The church shouldn't have done this. The church shouldn't have done that. This was not okay. That was not okay. And went through and listed all the things that she had just kind of not confessed to me, but had, you know, I've got a bone to pick kind of thing. And she said something that I will never forget. She goes, I did not realize how badly I needed to hear that from a Christian. Like to hear a Christian say, you're right, this is not okay, and that's not okay. And so I think in a lot of ways, the TV series did that, is they took a character, and he did not affirm all the bad things that happened. And he actually behaved in a way that does positively reinforce who Christ was. In fact, there's a researcher from Biola, her name's escaping me right now, but she did her dissertation on atheists who converted to Christianity. And one of the number one things that they found was that it was them meeting a Christian who defied their expectations or the stereotypes.
That's so true. I think a lot of times non-Christians who've never been around Christians only have whatever media interpretations or caricatures, speaking of caricatures, of Christians. And so that's what they think it is if they, you know, I've never met one. Well, one thing I want to tell our listeners that I really appreciated, and this comes out in the last two episodes of the show, episodes 7 and 8, is that both in the book and the show, Calvin, it's kind of like a flashback, and Calvin is taking on kind of correspondence by the very minister that you're talking about in the book and the show. And they just start writing letters, and then the book and TV series talk about how the letters suddenly stop, but they start writing all these letters back and forth about faith and lack of faith and just different things. And one of the things that happens in the TV show in episode 7 is the minister says, you know, one thing, I'm so glad that you found someone. You didn't think that you would ever find someone. And then you found this wonderful woman that you wish you could marry and all this stuff, because he said, well, I'm afraid she doesn't want to marry me. He said, you should see that as a gift, because, you know, God created us to be in relationships or have companionship with one another. And so I think because he does that, there's something there for Christian apologists to talk about. Well, you know, how was, you have the differences between the books showing Darwinism and then somebody who has faith, although this minister is quite progressive, but just the ideas that are there that you can see that, yes, God did create Adam and Eve to be in a relationship with one another and have a relationship with God and all those things. So I think there's some really great ways that a Christian apologist can talk about truths of Christianity and does God exist and why were we created just through some of the toss-off comments that are made in the last couple of episodes of the TV series in particular. But, you know, as I mentioned, you know, with all the 272,000 comments and almost 2 years now on the bestseller list, I think a lot of people are going to know someone who read it or is thinking about reading the book or someone who's watched the TV series. So is this something that Christians could read or is this something that Christians could watch on Apple TV Plus?
Yeah, I think they absolutely could. So I wouldn't say that the book is as enjoyable as the TV series, but the book does present some of the kind of really basic apologetics questions that you're going through, like how you know that God exists, what's the difference between evidence and faith, and you know, what about the Bible? Is that reliable? You know, what's the difference between Christ and Christians? I think that's something that a lot of people get tripped up on. They think that a bad example of a Christian is a bad, it means that, you know, Christ doesn't exist or that God doesn't exist. And that's not very logical. The TV show, I think, allows for a lot more interaction with different things. Like you said, the things of, you know, family, the things of justice, the things of what does it look like for a non-Christian to have that relationship or a Christian to have a relationship with a non-Christian. And just the idea of what were we created for? What is our telos? What are friends and family supposed to be? There's so many jumping off points. What is the role of questions within a Christian's life? Hugely important. There's so many things to kind of springboard off of there that I think this is one of those things where you could probably get a group of ladies together and you could sit around and you could watch this and really have some good conversation, you know, whether or not people are Christian or not. The book is, I mean, you could do a book group with the thing, but the group doesn't really empower people to be anything more than mad at God or mad at religion. So that isn't as much the ideal way to start conversations. But if for no other reason, I think sometimes Christians need to read things to know what people are saying, know what their impression is, know what the stereotype is, because you won't even know how to defy the stereotype until you know what that stereotype is to begin with. And what's something that could trigger someone that you didn't even realize? This is going to be a trigger point where you say, well, you just need to have faith and not ask questions. You know, that's not a healthy response to someone who has questions. So it's like, it's good to find out kind of who the boogeyman version is that people are reacting to, but also have something like the TV show where it gives you topics that you can then jump off of and then have conversations.
Well, I hope this was an interesting dive into a national bestseller right now. As a matter of fact, probably international, because I want to tell our listeners it's been translated into more than 40 languages. Well, on a much lighter note, there's all kinds of holidays. In fact, there's a holiday for every single day of the year, probably. But on March 25th, it's Tolkien Reading Day holiday. So what's your favorite Tolkien book to read? Speaking Ooh. Of reading.
Yes, Tolkien. Trying to decide if I like Hobbit or Lord of the Rings more. I think I like the Lord of the Rings more just because it has a little bit more of that real spiritual, you know, kind of the epic spiritual battles that are going on. I know that in the past I've watched some of those battles on TV of, you know, this the battle between good and evil. And I've told John, I was like, you know, sometimes that feels more real than anything we're seeing around us right now, that I just feel like there's a spiritual war going on in our world. And so sometimes it feels like you're getting to take a peek back into what's actually going on. So probably Lord of the Rings.
Well, thanks, Hillary, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to episode 385 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Hillary Ferrer. She's written an online book review, and her article is called Lessons in Anger, The Global Phenomenon of Bonnie Garmus's Lessons in Chemistry. And you can read her article for free at our website, equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.